are listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch. www.hearstranch.com.
This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. Edible Communities is a growing family of more than 50 independently owned publications across the United States and Canada. Our publications, as well as our Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network, connect you to the local food movement through talking with family farmers, producers, growers, chefs, filmmakers, authors, and food artisans and activists of all kinds. The Edible Community Show is hosted in rotation by Kate Manchester of Edible Santa Fe, Deborah Shapiro of Edible Green Mountains, and myself, Marla Camp of Edible Austin. I'll be talking today with a documentary filmmaker, Anna Sophia Joannis, who directed the new film, Fresh, which is being distributed through their production company by licensing DVDs for home showings and community screening events throughout the country. We'll also be giving away a home screening licensed DVD of Fresh, so listen for how you can win that during our first part of the show. Then we'll welcome organic farmer Carol Ann Sale back to our show for a conversation about what's happening downtown on the farm. And then as a preview for the 2009 American Cheese Society National Conference and Festival happening in just a couple of weeks in Austin, Texas, we'll meet Whole Foods Market global cheese buyer Kathy Strange and talk with award-winning artisan cheesemaker Edgar Diaz of Lucky Layla Farms and Dairy. So we'll take a short break and be right back with our first guest, Fresh director and producer, Anna Sophia Joannis. Welcome back to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Documentary film director and producer Anna Sophia Joannis was born in Portugal and grew up in Switzerland. She's lived in this country for the past 15 years or so, graduating from Columbia Law School and founding a nonprofit called Real Youth, a video production program for underserved youth. Her first documentary, Generation Meds, explored our fears and misgivings about mental illness and medication. Anna's second documentary is Fresh, a film that celebrates the farmers, thinkers, and business people across America who are both challenging and reinventing our food system. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you very much, Marla.
Anna, as a documentary filmmaker, you make films to make a difference, you know, to shed light on things that matter and motivate your viewers to take action. How did you come to choose the subject of food and the local and sustainable food movement in particular as a focus for this second film of yours?
I think I chose food as an excuse, really, to talk about finding meaning in our action, finding meaning in our lives. You know, I think that food is an incredibly powerful subject matter. I mean, not only do we all eat and we all have really strong memories of food, you know, especially from childhood, but food is you know, it's intimate, it's cultural, it has so many wonderful qualities, especially for a filmmaker. And it's become more and more there's been a rising awareness about the importance of food in our health, in our community, in our environment. So I think that food was just an incredible entry point to discuss what was very much at heart for me, which is this feeling that, you know, we're so bombarded with negative news in the media, and so much of it is so complex and so big that it's hard to feel that what you do matters. And I really wanted to address this because it seems to me that you know, it cannot be the case that we're just passive observer in a world going, you know, kind of crazy. You know, it seems to me that there is there is something to be said about the fact that we are the creator of our world. We are participants. And if you don't feel that your action matter, your individual action matter, or that you're part of a collective, you know, action or a collective participation, then it's very hard to act on your belief. And so I thought food was a great entry point to discuss that. That's just one of the I think main reasons.
Well, that's so important. And you know, your movie Fresh opens with Farmer Joel Salatin calling to his pigs out in their sunny pasture, and then he's explaining to us how they're expressing their essential pigness by running around and, you know, rolling happily in the mud. And then you cut to a conventional farmer, George Naylor, who's telling us that Americans fear only one thing, inconvenience, as you're showing an ever-rolling checkout conveyor filled with conventional and processed food products. And following that is Michael Pollan talking about, you know, the hidden costs of all this in our industrialized food system. And then there's some segments with some disturbing footage, you know, from a factory chicken farm and some other, you know, feedlot images. But then there's this visual moment in the film where our heart just takes this giant leap, and you go back to Joel Salatin's farm and, you know, the beauty and the sunlight and his philosophy about how farmers should be stewards of the earth, you know, and should look to nature as a template for, you know, how we raise and grow our food. And you create such strong emotional ebbs and waves with this film that you're able to move the viewer along, you know, without it feeling like we're being preached to or shocked into changing how we feel about something. And I think this is one of the things that really makes your film different from others that cover similarly, you know, topical subjects like this. And so why did you decide to bring so much of this positive emotion, you know, to what could have essentially been a doomsday-type message film?
Well, I think that you know, and thank you so much for this question and also for, you know, such a great kind of analysis of the movie. My reaction to all of the negative news is a feeling of paralysis. And when I started researching the subject, I realized that what truly motivated me into action was when I felt inspired. And I felt inspired by people. I felt inspired by their vision, by their sheer energy. And I met so many just amazing people, and I learned about so many great initiatives and such innovative work that I felt really moved into changing. And it took me a while, but it really kind of sipped in. And I wanted to create that feeling of inspiration in others. It was just basically recognizing in myself what worked, what made me, you know, I think that we all have a yearning to connect. And connect is very broad, and it can mean a lot of different things. But I think we all kind of deeply desire to feel connected and to feel that what we do has meaning and matters. And so I think that's what the movie tries to carry, you know. And I think that the message of hope and inspiration is necessary to help us turn a lot of our belief into reality, into action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things too. There are two aspects to the whole food movement that you cover really well in the film, and you do this by that getting close to the people involved. One is the subject of food justice, in terms of, you know, how we get access to good and healthy food for America's underserved communities. And you know, how do you get food into the urban food deserts? And the other is the difficulty in getting local food in general just to the conventional marketplace. And you do this with your segments on, he's so inspirational, the food activist and urban farmer Will Allen. And then the other is on the independent supermarket owner David Ball. I was really curious, how did you find them and their stories? And tell us a little bit about what they meant to you.
You know, Will Allen, you know, is this activist that you mentioned in Milwaukee, is a bigger than life figure. He's literally bigger than life. He's 6'7", former basketball player. He's been working on his farm in Milwaukee for over 15 years now, and created just a model of not only urban agriculture and what you could do on 3-acre farms, not only how much you can grow on 3-acre farm, but how you do it through relationship. He recycled a million pound of food residue from the city of Milwaukee, from a bunch of partners that he's made. And he has a very big crew of volunteers. He works with a lot of young people from the community, from the African-American community, especially in Milwaukee, and train them. He works directly with restaurants. It's a working farm. They provide a lot of food to local restaurants. He created a basket program to make food affordable to the Milwaukee community. He provides to school. He sold 100,000, I think, tilapia fish to the school system of Chicago. So, I mean, what he does is so diverse that it's hard to really fit into one movie. You'd have to have the whole movie about Will Allen. But he's really, like, just bigger than life. And he's recently been getting more and more attention, you know, I think partly because he received the MacArthur Genius Award last year. And it's very much deserved. I met him simply because, you know, I think that when you start getting interested in urban agriculture, in sustainable agriculture, you know, his name, he's been already a legend in those circles for quite a while. He's been organizing workshops all over the country and really inspiring, you know, people all over the world, all over the country and all over the world. Going to his farm and participating in one of his workshops was probably one of the highlights of my experience shooting fresh. You know, when you're sitting with 150 people from all over the world, I mean, all over the country mostly, all walks of life, all race, all interests, and to see how he's not only like teaching how to farm, but truly just spreading, you know, spreading hope, you know, like kind of seeding all of these possibility of how his model can be adopted, and it really gave me a vision of how grassroots, how diverse, how much potential the sustainable food movement truly had. I never quite had that vision until I participated in one of Will Allen's workshops. So he's truly a visionary, and I think, you know, all of the characters in the movies are visionaries, but Will is very unique. David Ball, you know, I think that what's fascinating about, you know, I didn't want to just make a movie about farming because, you know, it's really important to understand what sustainability means in the farm, but if you and I can't get access to that food, then it's meaningless. And farmers cannot do everything. They can be marketers and salesmen, and, you know, we're expecting a lot from our farmers right now, and farmers market are great, but they're limited. I mean, I don't get a chance to go to a farmers market very much, and most people never shop in farmers markets. So it was important to start talking about, well, what about distribution? How do we make this food available to everyone? And I think that supermarkets are a very important part of this. And a lot of people, you know, vilify supermarket, but, you know, we need to act at many, many, many levels and to change the system at many levels. And David Bull is an example of not only how do you survive in an environment, a business environment, where things are becoming so incredibly consolidated, where he has to compete with Walmart. You know, how does he stay alive as a big, you know, a big supermarket, but yet, you know, a small local family-owned supermarket faced with, you know, this global giant Walmart? And what he did is you know, basically partner up with a farmer's co-op and bring their food to the supermarket and promote this idea of a farmer's market 7 days a week in the supermarket. And so it's fascinating both as a successful business model and as showing how when you create this partnership in your community, you can not only give your customers the best possible product, but you're revitalizing the local economy. The ripple effect financially, economically, in the community is enormous. You're creating jobs. And you're allowing farmers to do what they do best, which is farm, instead of having to do everything else. So I thought it was a really important model to showcase.
Well, and I think that is such an inspiration, too, to show not only how we as individuals, you know, can make a difference, but how a business model can really make a difference as well. And it sort of segues into this other question I have for you about distribution. This is a grassroots film that you've made about a grassroots movement. And, Anna, you've taken this model all the way into how you're actually distributing the film as well. And can you tell us how you're doing this exactly and why it's so important for this film to be shown in living rooms and church basements as well as town hall meeting-type settings? And what do you hope to accomplish here doing it this way as opposed to rolling it out in a mainstream theater environment?
Yes, definitely. I made the movie. For 3 years making the movie, I daydream about how this movie could be useful for the people that I was filming. Like, how can a movie make a difference? You know, it'd be wonderful to have it, you know, in theater for people to watch and just appreciate, hopefully, the skills and heartfulness of the movie and just enjoy it. But how does it actually make a difference? How does a movie become a tool, a platform for change? And I think that what the distribution strategy is the outcome of having really thought about it for years and talking to the people that I wanted this movie to help and try to figure out how that is. And again, like what's powerful about the grassroots movement is that it is grassroots, is that it is, you know, people coming out of people's desire and yearning for change. And so it was important for me that you know, a fresh be not just watched, you know, in a theater or in your in front of TV by yourself, but that it leads to a potential action. And what better way than to see it communally, to see it with other like-minded individuals, to meet at the end of the screening a panel of farmers and experts and activists that can tell you what's available in the community, or to watch it, you know, in your living room, but with several people from the neighborhood, and to discuss, you know, what tips they might have about how to, what do they focus on, what organization do they know, what can we do as a community, do we want to plan a garden? I mean, you know, again, like, how can the conversation, how can fresh trigger a conversation that then leads to and inspire people into acting? So that's why we are not selling right now individual copy of the movie. We only selling screening licenses and hoping that we can generate a lot of energy and action out of the movie. And you know, yeah, I guess that's you know, basically the answer.
Yeah, and so what you can do is you can go to your website, freshthemovie.com, and you can select what level of screening you want to have your license for, and you pay a small fee. For especially, it's a sliding scale, so if you're only showing it at home for like 20 people, it's, I think, $20 a copy for the DVD rights. And then it goes up a bit if you're going to show it to 50 or more people, up to 100. And then if you do an even larger showing, then you actually take a cut of the ticket sales so that you're helping to finance your film. At the same time, you're making it available to a large number of people on this kind of, you know, house party style method, you know, and model, which I think is really exciting and interesting. Are you finding that you're getting an interest from the press and media by doing it this way as well?
No, you know, it's fascinating. I had the most wonderful conversation for an article by a young woman just yesterday, and she is in Pittsburgh, I believe. I've been talking to a lot of bloggers and kind of a non-mainstream press, and she was saying, you know, Fresh is more accessible to people like me in a small town than Food Inc. or other, you know, mainstream documentaries or films that are only in select number of cities for, you know, 2 weeks a month. And yet, you know, when I talk to the mainstream media and I say, would you please write a review of Fresh, they tell me you're not doing a theatrical release. Therefore, you know, we're not going to do a review because you're not available. We are available. We are actually more available. We sold in less than a month, over 400 home screening and community screenings. With this method, I think we're going to reach just as many people in a more meaningful way. It's very hard to get the mainstream media to respond to it. And, I'm very optimistic. I think that because, you know, Fresh is catching up at like a wildfire, and there is so much the response has been so amazing, I think that eventually the media will respond as well. You know, it's funny, my one mention that was supposed to happen in the New York Times magazine, this woman wrote a great article by Will Allen, and she interviewed me for the article, and she was going to put Fresh in the article. And then when I read the article, I wasn't in it, so I, you know, I emailed, and I was like, hey, what happened? And she basically, like, the magazine editor had had to cut part of the articles because of limitation in the number of words, and they just cut the reference out. So my one opportunity so far has been taken away. But I do believe that the first, you know, it's all a matter of like kind of getting the first article or the first major television appearance. And there is definitely interest. I mean, you know, we've talked to Good Morning America, and you know, I mean, people are enjoying the movie. They're just trying to find a way to, you know, in their framework, in what they think is a national distribution, to pitch the movie to the audience. So it's going to be interesting to see how we become more visible in the mainstream media, but I'm very confident that we will.
Finally, you know, I'd like to close with a heartfelt thank you for making this film. I think this film has the power to move the local food movement along. And, you know, you quoted a Chinese philosopher in a recent interview saying that hope is like a road in the country. There was never a road, but when many people walk on it, the road comes into existence. Also, yeah. You're just a few weeks away, I know, from having a baby, which I imagine hasn't been far from your thoughts lately. So I'm wondering, do you have any closing words for us on what you hope we can take away from your film?
What I hope you can take away from my film?
Yes, what you hope we can take away from the film.
Yes. I think that I'd like to... I was at a screening in Seattle, and a young man said, you know, I never thought that I would watch a movie about food that would move me so much emotionally. And he's like, I don't think it's about food. I think there's something else there. Like, can you tell me, like, is there, am I responding to something that you're trying to do in the movie? And I was so happy with this question because, like I said at the very beginning of the interview, to me this is really not about food. Food is just a great excuse. What it is about is really, like, for each one of us to tap, to recognize that desire to be connected, to have a meaningful life, to find that our actions actually have an impact, to recognize the impact, because our actions, regardless of what we think, are incredibly impactful. And I think that food is just a great place to see that, to recognize it, and to see that, you know, like the amazing ways in which everything connects together. And so I think that what I'd like the movie to do is to tap into that yearning, to make people feel inspired, to connect with others, to see where in their life at this point they can do something. You know, I feel like so much of the environmental movement has been guilt-driven, of, you know, most kind of activist movement has been guilt-driven. And, you know, this is really not about guilt. It's about pleasure. It's about meaning. It's about really good, positive things. And so, you know, even though change does happen, it doesn't happen out of fear or anger or guilt. I think it happens out of something really positive within us. And so, you know, I always tell people, like, you know, I'm not a purist. I'm not perfect. None of us are. You know, just find a place in your life, you know, and decide what you want to do about it. And you know, start wherever you are. It's not an all or nothing thing, you know. Anything you do is important. We are not overwhelmed with all that we could be doing to make change happen. So I think that that's the main message I hope people come up with. And you know, you mentioned that I will have a baby very soon. And, you know, it's funny, people ask me about that, like how it connects to the movie. And I think that, you know, again, like the movie changed me in a very deep way. And so I think that, you know, in some ways, like in you know, my I think that the way I'm thinking about this child is probably different because of the movie in some ways, but I don't quite know. It's too new at this point. I mean, definitely the way I eat has been influenced, but that's just very a small part of it. And you know, I think that we have a lot of work to do to make this planet habitable. And so when you know, with the threat of global warming, to have a child now in some ways very, to me, it's very scary. So, you know, I feel like in some ways I need to hold on to this hope and to this desire to at least try to make change happen possible.
Anna, thank you so much for what you're doing for your baby and for all of us, and I thank you so much for being with us today. Go to freshthemovie.com to find a screening near you or to set one up, large or small. In Austin, we're having a larger screening on Tuesday, August 25th at Boggy Creek Farm, presented by Edible Austin, the Alamo Drafthouse Roadshow, and the Front Porch Project, that will be a fundraiser for the Sustainable Food Center and feature a host of nonprofit community groups and local food producers for an evening of conversation, a locally sourced picnic, and a viewing of the film. You can find details for this event on the freshthemovie.com site or on edibleaustin.com. And if you'd like to win a home license copy of the DVD of Fresh, that's the license for viewings for up to 20 people, email us about what you're doing to help change our food system and send it to Marla, M-A-R-L-A, at edibleaustin.com. Be sure to include your contact information and your mailing address. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. With us now is pioneer organic farmer, writer, and blogger Carol Ann Sale. She, along with her husband Larry Butler, own two organic farms, one of which is a five-acre urban farm located just a couple of miles from the Capitol in downtown Austin. She and Larry were early pioneers of organic farming here in Central Texas, and Carol Ann has been an eloquent spokesperson for organic and small family farming over the years. She's authored several books, writes a regular column in Edible Austin, and has an avid following of her weekly Farm Stand newsletter, and also blogs weekly now about farming and whatever else is on her mind at the Atlantic's Food Channel. Welcome to the show, Carol Ann.
Thank you, Marla. It's good to be back on.
Great. Carol Ann, you've had a chance now to see both of the two new food movies out right now, Food Inc. and Fresh.
Yes,
so,
I am.
So now that people are getting a chance to see these films, and hopefully they're getting out to a widespread audience, they're suddenly more aware about what's happened to our food system, and I think they're going to be scared. So what now? I mean, what can we do to help them process this information and do something with it? And what do you want to tell or teach them to do?
Well, you know, being scared is kind of good in a way because it makes people get serious and try to figure out the way out of the situation. And we do have a bad situation regarding the food in this country, and they are right to be scared. So there are things that they can do, and they can move slowly on it. They don't have to just quit eating altogether or go camp out at a farm somewhere. But there are a lot of things they can do to lessen their dependence on the industrial food system. I think a lot of people primarily buy their groceries, their vegetables, their meats, their whatever, in grocery stores. And, you know, if you'll just go into a grocery store and kind of roam around the edges, you usually will find the things that are more like real food, like the vegetables and the meat that's all pink in the case and everything. And if you stay out of the center of the store, you'll avoid a lot of the things that are all prepared for you, that are all mixed up with things that you can't even read what the label says. You don't know, have any idea what the ingredients are. If you can stay away from that stuff and just get things that look like real food, a banana that looks like a banana, you know, broccoli that's not already chopped up and put into some sauce that's in a package. And so if they'll just do that one step, just stay out of the center of the store, because, you know, oddly, in the center of the store are also usually a lot of supplements and vitamins with the intention that somehow if you come out of the grocery store, at least if you have those, you'll have some nutrition. But if they can kind of stay on the outside, that would help. Don't buy anything with a list of ingredients on the label. Just stick with real stuff. And then, of course, that's the basic. But if they could get themselves to a local farm market, a farmer's market, a farm stand, a roadside stand, anything, where they can look the person in the eye and know that they grew that food and ask them how they grew it, especially if you're talking about vegetables, and buy directly from the dairy, buy directly from the man who raises the cattle. If they could do that, just buy directly from the farmer, then they're up many notches on the ladder towards real food. So, you know, once they've got all that good food, if they will just try to cook at home more often, you know, just don't eat out every meal. Cook at home. Get your children in the kitchen with you and teach them to cook. And if you don't know how to cook, get the recipe books out and learn together. And use things that you have to chop up, not something that you just throw the pouch in a pot of boiling water or in the microwave. In fact, maybe even get rid of the microwave, you know, because that's a convenience item that is going to lend itself more to the packaged products. So just chop the stuff up, throw it in a saute pan and stir fry it, and it doesn't take any time at all, and it'll be good. So get your children in there cooking together. And then, of course, you're going to get tired of cooking all the time, being a house slave and so forth, kids and slaves. So you do want to eat out every once in a while. But, you know, most people will eat out frequently. Lunches are out while they're working. So the first thing you do is you start taking your lunch from home and the lunch that you prepared with real food. And you eat your lunch out of the little brown bag. And that's one meal that you didn't eat in a restaurant. But if you do want to go out and relax, have kind of a vacation from the kitchen, choose restaurants that buy from the local farmers. And, yes, it will be more expensive. But if you've already curtailed your weekly twice, three times a week eating out, and you only go once a week, like a kind of like a favor, a vacation, then you can afford those more expensive places. And they will be more expensive because they are paying the farmers fair prices. So those are some of the things that you can do without ever sticking a seed in the ground and growing a garden in your backyard. But, of course, that is the ultimate, to grow your own garden, grow something, even if it's a few pots on the patio. Grow some lettuce in the winter. Grow a tomato plant, anything. Primarily, also, to learn how to do it. And, of course, get the children involved. Get them in there. Let them plant the seeds. Let them pull the carrot out of the ground. If they pull the carrot out of the ground, they'll eat the carrot. If they cut the broccoli off, they'll eat the broccoli. This has been proven so many times. We see it all the time. People come into the farm stand, especially this year, you know, with the economy the way it is and everything. People are wanting to save money, and they're worried about the food supplies, just like two horrible things have come to their consciousness all of a sudden. And they come and ask for advice on how to grow a garden and so forth. And we've become counselors this year on how to do it. And their children are with them, too. And so that's a beautiful thing.
Well, and Carol Ann, I just want to say we're going to have to wrap it up here just a minute, but maybe on the next time you're on our show, you can talk more about how you actually can grow that garden in a healthy way and talk to us about what makes the soil a real asset for doing that. And I just want to, in summary, you listed some wonderful things. Stay out of the center of the grocery stores. Go to farmers markets and farm stands whenever possible. Cook at home. Involve your kids. Definitely, when you do go out to eat, choose restaurants that use local food and buy and that they buy from farmers too. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, ultimately try to grow as much of your own food as you can. So I really appreciate that. You've got great advice for us, and I really enjoyed having you on the show today, Carol Ann.
Well, thank you, Marla.
Good. Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back in a minute with a preview of the 2009 American Cheese Society's upcoming conference, competition, and festival. So don't go away. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. I'd like to welcome our next guest, Kathy Strange. Kathy is a tireless champion of artisan, organic, and sustainably produced food. During her tenure as the global cheese buyer for Whole Foods Market, she's orchestrated the first dedicated organic cheese shipments from Europe to the United States, and she represents Whole Foods Market in the Cheese Importers Association of America. Kathy is past president of the American Cheese Society and has judged cheese competitions internationally. She's also a member of the Cheese of Choice Coalition, working with the Cheese Importers Association and Old Ways Preservation and Trust to advocate for maintenance of raw milk products legislation. And she's on the board of the Raw Milk Cheesemakers Association, too. Kathy has also been honored internationally with membership in the Guild des Fromagers de Saint-Ougazon, I'm probably massacring that, the most celebrated association of cheesemongers and specialists in France. And that's a high honor indeed. Kathy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Marla.
Can you tell us a little bit about your commitment, your personal commitment to small and artisan cheese producers around the world and the importance of preserving these traditional methods of making cheese?
Well, I think one of the most important things from my aspect is that we have a very young food culture in the United States, and what we don't have the opportunity to do is experience some of these traditionally produced products. So my advocacy is going out, trying to find a true source for these products and get them in the mouths of the American consumers. And traditional production doesn't necessarily mean it has to be in Europe or the United Kingdom, but it also can be in our backyard. So it's also supporting local and regional makers of traditional cheese products. Well, I am also a big advocate for RBGH-free milk for further process to make cheese, raw milk, and farmstead. So I think all of those go really in line with providing the experiences for the American consumer to taste traditionally produced products.
Can you talk a little bit about the what the difference is between raw milk and when it's used in making cheese and raw milk products and traditional pasteurized products?
Absolutely. The one thing that's a little bit different from the raw fluid milk issue and raw fermented milk issue is just that during cheese production, milk is heat-treated a bit, and that's just an essential part of making cheese, that the milk is heated so that the curds and whey separate when rennet is added to it. So some of that bacteria that is deemed potentially harmful is eliminated during that process. So what we do know is that some of the bacterial component provides a wide array of flavors based on the terroir and also the breed of the animal. So you do lose a little bit of some of the harmful bacteria that seems to be aggressively being pursued by our regulatory agencies domestically and even abroad, because it's a big issue not only in the United States but in Canada and Australia. Part of what's the difference with raw milk is being able to get some of those very complex characteristics that some of our ancestors were able to taste with milk. Now with homogenization and pasteurization, not all of those delicate nuances and complex flavors come out. However, there are some traditional producers that seem to get an intense amount of flavors out of pasteurized products. And with the government's regulation of 60 days, we do get to taste a lot of these products because raw milk cheeses are not banned in the United States. They're just regulated in terms of age.
I see. What are you doing specifically, or what do you think is what we should be doing to preserve our cheese-making traditions domestically in this country? And what are you seeing around the country that's helping this process?
Well, I think there's a big revolution going on with American cheesemaking, and I've been seeing it for the last 10 to 15 years. There, not only has the artisan movement taken hold as Americans have traveled more and learned more about food cultures around the world, so that they become more in touch with what's happening in their backyard, and I'm sure you've experienced that through the local movement. So really, Americans are learning more about where their food comes from. So 100 years ago, when immigrants were coming to the United States and first making cheeses, so we're looking at four or five generations, we were producing cheeses traditionally, and so you were getting cheeses that tasted like some of their countries of origin in terms of immigration. But as they've refined the industrial processing around cheeses, we went to a very bland style of cheese production, and that's what I think a lot of Americans are used to, just a plain cheddar cheese, a very mild cheddar cheese for the most part. But there's quite a wide range, and there's soft ripened products to hard products to wash rind products. We're seeing some of the productions go back to reflect some of the traditional productions from Italy, styles from the UK around cheddars. We're seeing a big movement around cloth bandaged. We're seeing further affinage of products in the United States. We're seeing products from Switzerland being duplicated. So we're seeing not only a duplication of traditional products, but we're seeing a revolution around what we're calling American originals. Mm-hmm. And you see that through the American Cheese Society. Literally 10 or 15 years ago, there were maybe only a handful of producers, let's say even less than 100, and now there are over 400 artisan producers. And this year alone, in the annual competition, there are 1,326 entries. And this shows a vast interest not only in cheesemaking being a viable business enterprise, but also a level of quality, because if these cheeses weren't good, these cheesemakers would not be in business, because Americans do vote with their dollars. And this is really a good thing for all of us that really care about artisan production and care about getting back to the roots and knowing where your food is coming from.
Well, that's kind of a perfect segue into my last question, which was to for you to tell us a little bit about the history of the American Cheese Society and their conference and competition and festival, and you know what specifically we can expect this year besides what it sounds like a whole lot more cheesemakers and a much more robust and vigorous competition.
Well, the American Cheese Society started 26 years ago, so it's really a group that's in its infancy, and it's a nonprofit group basically run by a lot of volunteers that are very much committed to cheese making. So there's a diverse group of members, and not only in distribution and retailing, but also in cheese making. But really at the heart of the group is just sharing the message about what cheese is. So at this annual conference, we'll have a full day just for the cheesemakers to advance themselves technically around the knowledge. And as you're probably aware, there's a lot of legislation going on that impact all producers in the United States. So we're going to devote a day around learning methodologies that will help them improve not only their food safety, but to be able to create different products for us. And then we'll also talk about sustainability. We'll talk about a lot of methods that will help a retailer communicate to the consumer and also the distributor to get the cheese to you in a very, very good manner that you can taste it like it was produced on the farm or at the facility. So I think what this conference does is it does offer the annual competition, which I said has over 1,300 entries, and all of those are open to the public for viewing at the Festival of Cheese, which is the culmination of the event on Saturday evening. So you have the opportunity to taste all those cheese, and I get to taste cheeses that I never have the opportunity to taste on a daily basis, but also the opportunity for attendees of the conference to learn more about their trade and to continue to advance ourselves so that we're able to communicate about our passions and communicate to the consumers about the products.
Well, that sounds just great. I feel so fortunate to be in Austin for the conference this year. So, and I know that people come from all over the country to attend. You can go to cheesesociety.org to find out more about the conference and the events and activities to expect and how to register for the conference and which events are open to the public. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us. This has been very, very informative.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I'd love to come back anytime to talk about cheese.
Thanks, Kathy. I'm sure we will have you back.
We're
going to take a short break and come back with our second American Cheese Society guest, Lucky Layla Farms partner and cheesemaker, Edgar Diaz.
This morning, I looked out my door. I could tell my milk cow, I could tell by the way she lowed. If you see my milk cow, please drive that old heifer home. Put it low and dry. Cause I ain't had no milk and butter. You gotta treat me right, honey, day by day. Get out your little prayer book, get out on your knees and pray. Cause you're gonna need my help one of these days.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. In January 2004, Todd Moore, a third-generation dairyman from a local dairy in Plano, Texas, wanted to see the high-quality milk from his award-winning Guernsey and Jersey cows turned into a premium artisan dairy product. He found a partner in Edgar Diaz, who came to this country from Colombia, South America, in 2001, with 20-plus-some-odd years of experience in the milk processing business. The result has been award-winning artisan dairy products under the Lucky Layla Farms brand. Each of their products are all natural and handcrafted using milk from their own cows. They, as I mentioned, they have a large herd of I can't even say it. We'll get the best pronunciation on the Guernsey cows from Edgar. But each of their products have been winning awards, and several of Edgar's cheeses, including his creamy, fresh Campesinos cheese, won prizes at the American Cheese Conference last year. Welcome, Edgar.
Welcome, Marla. Thank you for inviting to your program.
Thank you so much for joining us. Edgar, what have you found to be some of the challenges to making cheeses in Texas as opposed to your native Colombia, both from a cultural as well as, you know, just the environment and climate standpoint?
Yep. I agree with you. When I received this question, I think it is producing cheese is more complex than following a simple recipe. In order to make a great cheese, you must to be reflect our culture, our shell life we want to give in, the circumstance, and find the perfect taste to satisfy diverse taste buds. On Lucky Laila, we try to do it. For us, it's an every single day challenger because we take away from the mass production and we go to make our cheese according with our old recipes. Right now, for example, in Lucky Laila, we have two fresh cheese. That means the Campesino is the basic form of the cheese in our country. It's a very soft cheese we make every single day and we eat the next day. We never have a cheese over 30 days on the fresh cheese. And then when we add a little spicy jalapeno, we create our Tex-Mex. That means these two cheeses, we try to go into the American market. It's difficult because the people don't know our cheese, don't know our Spanish name, but right now we have a little space where we can get it, our cheese, and the people really want to know who produced the cheese, how we make, and where is our milk coming from. But, of course, we have two edgy cheese. We have one we call Boyaca. It's a six-month-old cheese. It's very creamy. It's very smoothy on the taste, soft on the flavor. And we have another, it's a little bit more older, like 1 year. We call San Pedro. That is a little bit more stronger on the flavor. With these four cheeses, we want to conserve even the Spanish name like the way we made it in our country. We want to give it the person by our cheese knows it's only milk, it's our enzyme, and it's a little bit soft.
Mm-hmm.
That means fresh. That means natural. And we can control all the steps on the production. It's very difficult, but at the same time, it's very good for having a nice and a very natural product.
Well, about the production itself, I mentioned that you have a herd, your own herd of Guernsey cows that you have on the Lucky Laila farm. And I've been told that there's a high butterfat content with the milk from these cows. And that is what probably both gives the cheese a special character, but also does that present certain challenges in the cheese-making process itself?
Yes. Fortunately for our company, Tad started developing his own dairy for more than 30 years. The Guernsey milk is really, really totally different than the other milks on the market. We have more fat content. That means we have more flavor on our cheese. We have more protein. That means we have more ratio when we produce cheese. We have more carb, and we can have more cheese to offer to our customers. The other good thing is we have more B-carotene. That means the yellow color is coming from this ingredient. And it's special on the taste. They give an a little twist different than the other milks. And maybe one of the things is called more the attention is the A2 beta-casein. That's protein in New Zealand and Australia. They claim is different total to the A1, mm-hmm. which is the big difference. This kind of protein is more healthy. That means for you, Marla, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 big difference in our milk and in our final product than the other products on the market.
That's very interesting, and you can actually go to the Lucky Layla website, which is luckylayla.com, and read a lot about what these different cheeses are. And one of the things I appreciated on the website was you also tell people how to use some of these cheeses. And because some of the cheeses may be, especially the softer cheeses, may be somewhat unfamiliar, it's really nice to be able to be told ways you can use them and cook with them and things to pair them with as well. So, Edgar, will you be at the American Cheese Society conference?
Yes, I will be there and in two events. One of the meet with the cheesemaker. I'd be so happy to show our products over there. I'd be so happy to share with the people our experience, our good scenes and bad scenes at the same time.
Well, thank you, and good luck at the with the competition this year.
Okay, thank you so much, Marla, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks again to our American Cheese Society conference and festival guests, Kathy Strange and Edgar Diaz. You can catch up with them at the conference in Austin on August 5th through the 9th. Go to cheesesociety.org for details and how to register and what events you can go to that are open to the public, too. Thanks also today for our special guest, Anna Sofia Joannis. And please do go to the Fresh the Movie, that's freshthemovie.com, to find out how you can host a screening for the film for your friends and in your community. And don't forget to email me to win a copy of a home screening licensed DVD. So thank you all for listening to our Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network today. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for making this show possible. Now, next week, your host will be Deborah Shapiro from Edible Green Mountains, and I'll be back on August 10th. I encourage you to send me your comments and requests. Please let us know what you'd like to hear about. You can email me at Marla, M-A-R-L-A, at edibleaustin.com. I'll be back in 3 weeks, but tune in next Monday and every Monday for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network.